The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Professor Jagpreet Chatwal, Ph.D., is the director of the MGH Institute for Technology Assessment and an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. He's also an affiliated faculty member of the Center for Health Decision Science at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Meditation Research Program at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Dr. Chatwal is also one of the co-authors of an article entitled Estimated Reductions in Opioid Overdose Deaths with Sustainment of Public Health Interventions in Four U.S. States that was published June 9th in the journal JAMA Network Open. I had the good fortune of speaking with Dr. Chatwal the other day. We'll hear that conversation in a moment. But first, the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, the New York NGO Committee on Drugs, and the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS held a briefing recently on the topic of access to health for people who use drugs, including in prisons, entitled At the Intersection of Drug Policy, Health, and Human Rights. One of the people who presented at this briefing was Jess Morales from the Latin American Network of People Who Use Drugs, LANPUD.
Again, my name is Jess Morales. I am a bisexual woman. I am a mother. I am a feminist, and I'm also someone who uses drugs. I currently live in Guatemala City, and again, I'm part of the Latin American and the Caribbean network of people who use drugs. The network is currently present in 17 countries, and we aim to work as a regional point of reference to advocate, promote, and influence public policies and social frameworks for the elimination of stigma, discrimination, and racism of people who use drugs in the region. Today, I'm going to mention some of the, a little bit on the current situation of Latin America, but also the most urgent needs to reduce healthcare barriers for our community. First, during our work in the ALEP project, which is a multi-country project that's currently working on 11 countries in the region that's funded by the Global Fund, we have identified many of the barriers for a truly effective HIV response in our populations. First, I will say that it is important to continue emphasizing that drug use is transversal to all populations of people with HIV and key populations. This means that within all populations of people with HIV, there are people who are also drug users. In this conjunction with multiple factors that are already represent a barrier to access prevention and treatment services, it also generates special conditions of vulnerability for drug users. Next, again, stigma and discrimination against people who use drugs is also present within the same organizations of people who are living with HIV and other key populations. LANPUD presence in the project provided an opportunity for drug users to approach freely and to have someone to talk about their drug use, which showed that stigma is also present in their organizations and causes them to hide their use from their peers or from medical service personnel. We also identified that there is a tendency in the region to deny medical treatment to people who use drugs and alcohol, including people with HIV. There is a lack of public services for harm reduction and a lack of care services for the drug-using population on the part of the state. And the criminalization represents a barrier for a community-based organization to provide those services when the state cannot. The importance to include not injected drug users as a key population in HIV response, this is particularly important for the Latin American and the Caribbean region. We don't have a very big population of people who inject drugs, but we do have a large population of people who use this other type of drugs, and they must be included as a key population in the HIV response. In general, working with HIV projects has also given us the opportunity to apply for funding, to generate information, and to improve our advocacy by allowing us to denounce and speak up about the urgent demands of our population in spaces with decision makers and governmental institutions in the region. The region of South Central America and Mexico are among the regions most affected by the drug war. Central America and Mexico are a key point in drug trafficking from the South to the North and to Europe. We are drug-producing countries, and it is our farmers and communities in extreme poverty who must resort to the cultivation of psychoactive substances and plants in order to ensure their survival. The Latin American region is a high transit route for illicit drugs. This means that it is mostly in our territories where the fight against drugs is more violent. These are some of the examples of the human rights violations that we experience in our territories. Forced disappearances, extrajudicial executions, serious human rights violations, land theft from indigenous communities by drug trafficking organizations in cooperation with state institutions, criminalization and persecution of drug users, criminalization of human rights activists, discrimination, arbitrary arrest by police officers, including monetary extortions, and in case of women, these arrests are often also accompanied by sexual aggressions, healthcare access barriers, lack of public healthcare services, and lack of information regarding HIV prevalence in people who use drugs, in prison, and people living in the streets, communities. During our work with HIV populations, we've been able to identify and continuously advocate for a change in the prohibitionist policies as one of the most important changes needed to ensure that healthcare access to HIV population and people who use drugs are available. Our current drug policies in the region, Latin America and the Caribbean, are mostly punitive and prohibitionist. One of the most urgent needs in our region, as you all mentioned already, in order to safeguard the rights, the human rights of people who use drugs, is the decriminalization of possession for consumption. For an example, here in Guatemala, which has one of the most punitive drug policies in the region, the possession for consumption continues to be a crime, and it's the same mostly for the entire region. Regardless of the amount of drugs that you have, if you are detained by a police officer, it is going to be at the judge's discretion to determine based on the amount seized, if the person will be on trial for possession for consumption or as a drug trafficker. Which means this might mean the difference between spending 5 to 20 years in prison. And talking a little bit about harm reduction, the community this has been the continuous community response to focus on a risk and harm reduction perspective to fill up the gaps of healthcare services that the state is not able to provide. However, harm reduction is often criminalized, as it has happened in Brazil recently. This year, a community-based organization was criminalized for promoting harm reduction practices in this year's carnival. Our peers were subject to political and racist violence for promoting harm reduction. Again, an example here in Guatemala, because of the current drug policy, we are not able to even discuss harm reduction practices because it could be penalized with prison. Another thing that's very important for us is to create, to speak always from a gender and race perspective. In order to create HIV treatment and prevention strategies that are really address the inequalities and to ensure that healthcare is a possibility, it is important to speak from a gender and race perspective at all times. For us activists in Latin America, it is clear that the war on drugs has its deepest roots in the structural racism of our societies, and that women, sexual dissidents, and racialized people suffer disproportionately the consequences of this war on drugs day by day, a war that is currently being fought in our ancestral territories. As a conclusion, I would like to say that for the response to HIV to be really effective in Latin America and the Caribbean, we must first stop invisibilizing this region and at the same time understand that our particular political and social cultural situation is different from the rest of the world, and that the actions to ending AIDS and HIV should be tailored toward this specific social, cultural, and political factors. We need to move away from a prohibitionist and conservative discourses. We need to open more spaces to listen to what civil society organizations have to say. We need to ensure bilingual spaces, and we need to work to guarantee the fight for human rights so it can allow us to work with the most vulnerable population and ensure that our voices, because our voices are the ones that are in the middle of this very violent war every day. We need to have a space to speak in our language and also to have a priority space in decision making and in forums such as this. And to end, you can see in the presentation a couple of pictures from our organization and the work that we currently do. This is one of our activists present at the latest conference for AIDS in Canada, where included myself, many peers could not attend because of lack of visas. And these are the things that we need to consider in order to ensure that the HIV response is being truly effective in our territory. And that will be all for me. Thank you.
That was Jess Morales from LANPUD, the Latin American Network of People Who Use Drugs, speaking at a UN panel entitled At the Intersection of Drug Policy, Health, and Human Rights that was held on April 26th. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Professor Jagpreet Chatwal, PhD, is the director of the MGH Institute for Technology Assessment and an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. I spoke with him recently about his new article in JAMA Network Open, entitled Estimated Reductions in Opioid Overdose Deaths with Sustainment of Public Health Interventions in 4 States.
So it's no news that the opioid crisis has been declared an epidemic with the number of deaths rising. Several initiatives have been launched by the government, especially by the National Institutes of Health. If you look at most of these initiatives, they are implemented for a certain period of duration, maybe 1 year, 2 years. And we wanted to see what is the impact of such initiatives in those time horizons, and also look at what is the impact of sustaining or not sustaining those initiatives for a longer period of time. So that gives us some insights what we should do, and then how we can bring down the overdose deaths. That's the ultimate objective from all these initiatives.
So, in fact, one of them you named the Helping to End Addiction Long-Term Communities Study. Before we get further into the study, could you tell me about that? Because it looked fascinating.
Yeah, so this is one of the largest studies in the history of the National Institutes of Health, which is implementing many interventions in 67 communities with the objective that we can reduce overdose deaths in those communities. And communities can choose what kinds of interventions they can select from a given menu of options and implement them. And then over time, we would look at what is the reduction in overdose deaths in those communities. And so that we can inform in other parts of the country what has worked, what has not worked, and how people can look at in what settings what works, what kinds of interventions have the most impact.
In your research, you looked at 4 different communities. What were the communities, and what were the interventions you were looking at?
So in this study, we are not actually modeling those communities because the study is still ongoing. And in fact, what we're doing is we're looking at the states where those communities are located. We identified these are the four states where the study is ongoing: Kentucky, Massachusetts, New York, and Ohio. So we simulated the opioid overdose crisis in those four states and looked at the outcomes and projections under different kinds of settings. What if we scale up interventions? If we scale up treatment-related interventions, or we scale up distribution of naloxone, for example, what could be the impact on the overdose deaths? So it's the objective is to inform something and then to the policymakers before they're actually implemented, and also to inform other counties or states where they would like to initiate these kinds of interventions.
Let's run through your findings. Now, these were simulations. So,
Yes.
and you were looking at, and let's see, there's the medication for opioid use disorder, the expanded distribution of naloxone, and then there was a prescription intervention you were looking at. There was an actual 50% reduction, hopefully at least. That was the,
Right.
okay.
Yes.
So what did you find?
So one thing that so let me start with something that was a little surprising to some people is that the effects of prescription opioids, so safe prescribing. A lot of initiatives, a lot of focus has happened in the past on those safe prescribing options. We found that it will have a marginal impact on the reduction in overdose deaths at this point. And the reason is that the epidemic has shifted to illicit opioids. It's not the prescription opioids that's killing most of the people. It's the illicit opioids. So that brings us to the other interventions, which is the medications for opioid use disorder. We need to scale up the number of people who are taking medications. And also, we have to retain those people on those medications for a longer time period. As many people, they stop using medications and then they relapse. That's when the risk of overdose is the highest, right after that point. And third, we looked at the distribution of naloxone kits as a harm reduction initiative. So combine all these interventions, what we found was that in the next 2 years, we could see where like 13 to 22% reduction in overdose deaths across all these four states in the next 2 years. So that, and then again, we also look at this is we have to scale up the medications at a much higher level. So in this first simulation, we looked at increasing the number of people to the two by twofold, and that reduces the number of deaths by about 20% or so. But if we are expecting a sorry, it's in like in lower like around 13 to 15% with those twofold increase in the medications. We really have to scale up to fivefold to see a substantial reduction in overdose deaths, which is a bigger initiative, which is an aspirational goal. But if we do not make that aspirational goal our target, we should not be expecting a bigger reduction in overdose deaths. That's one of the messages in the study. The second finding, which was quite surprising, was that when we look at the sustainment of those interventions, what happens if, let's say, after 2 years, the study is going to be over, and then those communities, many of them may not have resources to continue those efforts, so they may naturally stop that study. Okay, if what are the interventions were, they stop that, and we see that once the moment those interventions are stopped, the number of overdose deaths are likely going to go up again in those communities, in those settings. So what it tells us is that the sustainment of those interventions is very, very important for a sustained impact on reduction in overdose deaths. And we simulated different settings. If we sustain those interventions for additional 3 years, we can see that the overdose deaths can reduce by 27 to 45% across those four states. Because the key, again, I'll emphasize again, sustaining interventions is the key for substantial reduction in overdose deaths in any given community or a given state, any given jurisdiction.
Which really shouldn't be surprising. I mean, we've seen this in any number of programs and reforms. The pilot project works. It shows that the concept is good. Could it be scaled up? Probably. Yeah, well, it was a pilot. We're on to something different. Oh, for God.
Yes, and this is this initiative is actually more than a pilot study. This is a full-fledged, heavily invested study by the NIH, and even with those efforts, we are seeing that if they're not sustained, the benefits could be washed out.
And the more, well, cutting down on prescription, cutting down on prescriptions doesn't sound like a really expensive intervention. So if anything was going to be cut, it would be the other two that actually cost money.
Yes, absolutely.
And it was a 50% reduction. I mean, that's huge. I would think that a lot of patients with legitimate need for medication to control pain would end up getting thrown out into the cold, well, into the arms of a street dealer, you know. I mean, talking about throwing the
Just to
baby out with the
clarify,
bathwater, you know.
just to clarify that this 50% reduction is, it's a what if scenario. We are not saying that this intervention is going to do 50% reduction. And second, this 50, whatever that reduction is, it's on misuse of prescription opioids. It's not for people who need those medications for pain. It's the misuse that we're reducing by 50%. And even up to 50% reduction, that's not going to change the trajectory of overdose deaths in the next 3 to 5 years.
Well, the next question I have is, what are the policy implications? But I think that's pretty clear. But if you could expand on them, that would be great.
So the policy implications, and based upon the interventions that we evaluated, clearly there is a need to bring more people in the treatment. Definitely. It's even if we bring increase the number of people by twice, it's not enough. We have to go much higher than that to see a substantial reduction in overdose deaths. And then in addition to bringing new people on treatment, medications for opioid use disorder, which are the evidence-based the practices, the medications, we have to keep them on treatment for a longer time. We need to think about the initiatives, like we sustain them, we create support system, people stay on medications for a longer period and do not relapse. That's the bigger policy implication. And third, also we looked at the distribution of naloxone as a harm reduction policy strategy, education on overdose risk that we should sustain. That's no brainer that we should continue. And because the more we do that, we would see that some effect of that and the reduction in the overdoses and then reduction in overdose deaths because of that harm reduction initiatives.
And these aren't the interventions you're describing. It's just expanding the availability of naloxone, distribution of naloxone, making, expanding the delivery of methadone and buprenorphine. These are, I mean, these are accepted mainstream for the U.S. These are just accepted mainstream kinds of interventions. This isn't like a radical departure.
Absolutely, yes. And the focus of this study was looking at evidence-based practices based upon the current evidence. And it's not exploring radical interventions, which there's, and clearly there's a lot of support. It's from the mainstream about these interventions. We need to find ways, methods to implement them at a wider scale and for a longer period, which requires resources. That brings us to the question, everything requires extra resources. So that has to be distributed to communities, providing that support is needed, essential.
It costs a few dollars, but with great, but something as simple as greater availability of naloxone and expanded delivery of methadone and buprenorphine, and there are thousands of families who could have been spared the heartache of losing someone to toxic drug supply and overdose
Absolutely.
for just a few bucks. So is there anything you can suggest that people could do in terms of supporting these projects, these interventions, getting some of these common sense, basic ideas going with their communities?
Yes, so there's no doubt these are ideas that people are aware of, as they have been talked about, they have been discussed in the past. What I believe would be really helpful is thinking about ways to make these happen, to implement them for a longer period of time. How do we create a system in place Because what may be missing in many communities is there may not be any physicians or prescribers for buprenorphine. Then the methadone clinic may be too far for many people to go there. So how do we make those system level changes so that we can achieve these targets? We all know that we have to bring in more people to treatment. The question is how? So thinking about that how is important at this point. And policymakers have to think about that with the communities, look at the resources they have, and then see what works and what doesn't work and learn from other communities.
I this is off topic, but I've got to ask. You created this thing called the Hep C calculator, and you're doing some work with the White House on their hepatitis C initiative. Do I have this right?
That's right.
Could you tell us about that?
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, hepatitis C, as it's a bloodborne disease. It's the main reason cause of transmission is sharing of needles. Again, there's a population who's been injecting drugs. That's the most common mode of transmission now. With hepatitis C, if it's a chronic disease, if you don't treat it, and most people, like the liver fail at some point, and it's death is inevitable in that point. But what's unique about Hep C is that we have a treatment, a cure for this virus now. It's a 12 weeks of treatment, 8 to 12 weeks of treatment. It's and that with 95% or more success rate. So people take those pills and it's become virus free. And this initiative, but it costs money. And the drugs, the treatments, they're expensive. And also takes effort to find those people. It's a silent disease. People don't know until it's too late. It takes more than a decade to show any symptoms. So what the national initiative is going to do is bring in the resources to find where those people are. So in the United States, there are more than 2 million people still infected with hepatitis C. And about half of them are not even aware of their infection status. So how do we find those people and treat them with those drugs which can now cure Hep C? So that's what this initiative is about. So we have now our work with the White House is evaluating the policy, the national initiative, and showing that by scaling up, it requires additional resources to find those people. We see that we were finding people by treating them. This is how much it's going to cost, but downstream we'll be not only saving lives, thousands of lives, but we will be saving future downstream events like liver cancer, need for liver transplant, which are very, very expensive, much more expensive than the treatment itself. So where it's going is that we see that this initiative can be cost saving within 5 years. And by 10 years, it will lead to additional savings in the dollars to the federal government.
That was my conversation with Professor Jagpreet Chetwal, PhD. He's director of the MGH Institute for Technology Assessment and an associate professor at Harvard Medical School, and one of the co-authors of an article entitled Estimated Reductions in Opioid Overdose Deaths with Sustainment of Public Health Interventions in 4 U.S. States that was published June 9th in the journal JAMA Network Open. That's all the time we have this week. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. I thank my guest, Professor Jagpreet Chetwal, and thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news
for
and
the
information
Drug Truth
about
Network,
drug policy.
This is Doug McVeigh
asking you
drugs.
To examine our
for
policy
now,
of drug prohibition.
Saying so
the
long.
Century of
so
Lies.
Long.
Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.